Hi, everyone. My name is Tim Mikelashvili, and I'm the host of the All Out Coach podcast. This is our show in which we share ideas that matter and that have a message to all of us. Today, I'm particularly excited because I have a guest whose ideas I probably reference the most in my videos and in my articles. So essentially, my guest is also my mentor because we find mentors based on the ideas that they stand for and that they share. His ideas tie evidence with emotions. With the All Out Coach, I want to evoke emotions so that we can change how we perceive and how we react to life around us. So I've envisioned having my guest today for quite a long time now, as you can imagine. So I'm extremely happy that we have his time. His name is Ron Carucci. And he is the managing partner of Navalent. He's a best-selling author, speaker. He is a contributor of Forbes, Harvard Business Review. He lives in Seattle with his wife and two children. He's a Seattle Seahawks fan. And I would like to give him a warm welcome. Ron, I'm glad to have you here today at All Out Coach. How are you?
I'm great, Tim. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks for all your wonderful, gracious support and lending your insights to the cause.
Thank you. How has 2021 been for you so far?
Well, you know, I think I feel like 2020 still has a hangover that hasn't quite worn off yet. Between our political landscape and this unfortunate, horrible pandemic. But that said, I think, you know, I still have lots of hope for this year. I still think this year can be very different than last year. And I'm hopeful that by the end of 2021, we'll be able to say that it was a dramatically good year and a very different year than 2020 was.
Yeah. I think that we are really due for a renaissance of ideas in 2021. So you are the perfect guest that has researched hundreds of companies globally. And I want to start by just asking you, what sparked your interest in your specialty, which is organizational transformation?
Gosh, you know, Tim, I think I've always been fascinated by how humans organize shared endeavor, how we come together to do, you know, even when I was a kid, I loved to organize them a stickball game. You know, you're from Long Island, you know what stickball is.
Yeah.
When there was going to be a block party or an event at school, I just loved the process of bringing people together to get stuff done. And I think that over the course of my life, where I participated and contributed and learned best is when, you know, humans come together. And then I found out that they can do that at scale, that you can bring together lots and lots of people to coordinate their efforts and synchronize their desires into outcomes that are transformational. But of course, when you add the fact that it is humans trying to do that, you're going to get all kinds of stuff in there that sometimes doesn't help. And so I fell in love with the notion of being able to get in there into that spaghetti ball and help untangle the parts that don't help and set in motion the parts that do to get outcomes that none of us could get on our own.
Absolutely. The synergy that you get as a result of a collaboration, right, of the diversity of people as well. You have just done some TED Talks that for me were just amazing. They told stories of people that share some of these nuances and insights from these organizations. How did you get inspired to write your latest book called To Be Honest?
Tim, I think all of us are a little bit soul weary from the stories that capture the headlines. The Wells Fargos, the Volkswagens, the Theranos, the Harvey Weinsteins. And so that's the picture of leadership and organizational life we assume. We presume guilt until we otherwise see something trustworthiness. And sometimes we're not proven wrong. But I had to believe that there were more good apples than bad out there. I wanted to believe that 5,000 people didn't wake up at Wells Fargo all on the same day and say, hey, here's an idea. I wanted to understand what were the conditions that made those people decide to go to the dark side. Because I thought if we could understand those conditions, we could prevent them. We could create organizations that people show up and want to tell the truth and want to behave fairly and treat other people with justice and want to serve a greater good rather than their own interests. And I knew there had to be people out there doing it. I knew that the world wasn't just one big, dark, corrupt cesspool. Right. And it turns out there are. It turns out that there are extraordinary organizations and communities of leaders in all walks of life, not just the business world, doing amazing things together. And I had the incredible privilege of curating their stories. It was a thrilling book to write because I got to be in the presence of people I want to emulate, people that I know to emulate, and whose examples we can follow. So it was a thrill. And I think what we've learned is that we have a choice. As individuals and as communities and organizations, we can choose to create conditions in which people show up and be their best selves and serve a greater good, or they show up and they do things they swore they'd never do.
Mm-hmm. So how did you embark on that research? Because it was a long research, right? It was a 15-year-old study that now you're going to be sharing with the world. Can you go into a little bit more specifics on the research?
Yeah, so we, you know, my organization does really forensic diagnostic work with our clients. And so we have an extraordinary database of interviews that we've done over the last 15 years. So we had 15 years of data, somewhere north of 3,200 interviews. And we brought to bear some incredible technology, IBM Watson's artificial intelligence work, that can sort of quantify and make sort of turn qualitative data into predictive statistics around behavioral conditions under which people would do certain things. So we had the incredible opportunity to use that technology to read the data and to make correlations and to make predictions about what kinds of behaviors and choices lead to what kinds of outcomes.
Yeah, that was what I was very impressed with when I read the article, because you had previewed some of the results, I believe, in a HBR, Harvard Business Review article.
Yep.
In fact, that inspired me to do a review on it with my network, with my friends. So you had even regressions there, and it's very statistical, and it's a very intricate portrayal of the various different reasons why it becomes a norm in an organization to lie. Right. And in that article, you highlighted four particular factors. Do those four describe the book, the focus of the book? Yes. And yeah. What are those four? Would you like to introduce them?
Sure. So I break the book down into those four parts, but I take two different angles at each. One, I look at the systemic realities of for the organization, but then I look at individuals. What can I do to be more truthful, to be more just, to be more purposeful? So the book has a wider reach for anybody, not just somebody leading an enterprise or a team. So the first one was clarity and identity. Be who you say you are. Yeah. All of our organizations make statements about themselves. They talk about who they want to serve in mission statements. They talk about values they want to emulate in their purpose statements. They talk about impacts they want to have in the world. Those are great. They make lovely posters, they go on nice screensavers, they make beautiful mugs and t-shirts.
Right.
but as it turns out, if that's all they do, and they don't do more than that, like show up in the actual actions and decisions of the organization, and show up in the behaviors of employees, now you've institutionalized duplicity. What you've said is that at this company, we say one thing and do another. But the great news is when you actually align your words and your actions, when you are who you say you are, now you are three times more likely to have people tell the truth, behave thoroughly, and serve a greater good. Mm-hmm. The second was accountability, meaning how do we measure the contributions of those who work here? Not how we reward them or pay for them, but how do we honor them? How do we treat people with dignity? How do we make sure the playing field of success is level for everybody, that there's justice? It turns out when people come to the table to talk to their boss about assessing their contributions, if they feel like that's been fair, meaning where you fell short, where you overachieved, how you contributed, how your talents were stewarded well, if that was done fairly with justice and dignity, now you're four times more likely to have people tell the truth, behave fairly, and serve a greater good. But if people come and feel like they were not seen well, they were overly categorized into numbers and labels that don't fit them, if they feel like you don't know what it took for them to accomplish or sacrifice what they did, now you're four times more likely to have people lie and cheat and be selfish. Yeah. The third was decision-making. So if the way information is shared with me, if the way I participate in decision-making, if the meetings I go to are transparent. In other words, I trust what's being said. It's not orchestrated theater. I believe that my voice is welcome, that I can dissent and share concerns without fear of retribution. Mm-hmm. If there is transparency in the way resources and decisions are governed, now you're 3.5 times more likely to have people tell the truth and behave fairly. But if I go into a meeting and it's all a ruse, if I begin to suspect the decision got made before the meeting, if I suspect that you're just asking me to talk just to make it look like I'm included, now you're 3.5 times more likely that I'm going to have to lie and cover up my mistakes. And the last one was cross-functional partnership or unity, the way we work with our adjacent spaces, right? So in pharma, R&D and commercial, the classic one, or discovery and development, in manufacturing, operations and supply chain, in every company, sales and marketing, the classic places where there are border wars. If the seams of the organization are stitched well, if there's cohesion and there's a sense of we at those intersections versus the typical sense of they, you know, and they who make my life miserable and drive me crazy. This was probably the biggest surprise in the findings. You are 6 times more likely to have people behave fairly, tell the truth, and act with justice. Because when you defragment the organization, you defragment the truth. But when you have rivalry, when you have we's and they's, when you have misaligned KPIs, when you have misaligned goals, when you have imbalanced resource allocations, now I have to fight to be right. So it doesn't matter whether I'm truthful or not, I just need to be right, make you wrong. Now you're 6 times more likely to have people lie, cheat, and serve their own interests first. And to your point earlier, Tim, it is, the statistics are cumulative. So if you do all 4 of those things particularly well, your organization is 16 times more likely to have people serve a greater purpose together, tell you the truth even when it's hard, and act fairly and with justice toward everybody no matter who they are.
Yeah, and that is an important point to emphasize, that they are cumulative, and you have such a significant data set to demonstrate that evidence. Is there a particular score that can evolve out of this that organizations can use as a guide, let's say?
I think hope one day I will, when I have enough data. I think for now the great news was that it's not all or nothing, right? So what we if you play with the statistical models, right, what you find is that even if you improve alignment between your identity and your actions, mm-hmm. by even 15% or 20%, you can see an uptake in honesty behavior by 10%, right? So you can move the needle on all of these, you know, progress versus perfection, and create incremental changes to make sure that your organization is built to deliver honesty and see. You know, again, if you have an enterprise of thousands of people spread across, that's a lot of changed behavior cumulatively.
I see. Now, how were you able to quantify some of the responses? Did you ask the same questions among all these leaders and executives globally? Or
that's the beauty of artificial intelligence, right? So you can then when you see correlations across data sets, so when you begin to build algorithms in a data set where certain linguistics or meanings begin to correlate with each other, then you can quantify them statistically. So you can begin to say from a recurrence or prevalence point of view, the prevalence of certain conditions creates the prevalence of certain other conditions. So it becomes predictive.
I see. Were there particular industries, Ron, that seemed to do better than others, particular fields, regions? Did you see any?
We didn't cut the data up by individual organizations. That would be a breach of our confidentiality agreement. So we didn't look at any individual company or industry or sector. Yep. I think certainly we know that there are cultural differences across the world with an understanding or definition of what honesty means. Right. There are certainly certain types of, like, sales are very prone to bribery in certain conditions where they have to do business in certain parts of the world. Financial services, you know, and the degree of regulation there, people who are prone to being motivated by money may be more prone to tip a scale or to blur a line. So I certainly think there are patterns we know about in the ethics field, in ethics studies, of where certain conduct can tip toward misconduct. But that wasn't the focus of our research. Ours was much more of how do you shape an organization to shape certain kinds of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the outcomes of being honest and having companies that share ideas in a safe environment, that do not have the border wars you just mentioned, what are some of the outcomes that they can look forward to from your research or from your observations?
What we learned was pretty extraordinary, right? So it is unmistakably clear that companies who are perceived to be honest far outperform those that are not. In brand loyalty, in product loyalty, in the ability to command premium prices, in their stock performance, they outperform the S&P 500 by a factor of 14. In employee retention, in attracting certain kinds of talent and keeping it. On numbers of metrics across any financial or marketplace or competitive performance, the companies who are seen as legitimately serving a purpose, legitimately acting with fairness, and legitimately walking their talk are by many, many metrics, perform way better than their counterparts.
Yeah. I was in a group panel a long time ago, and I remember asking the same questions to these leaders, to the executives, in terms of what are the company values that they stand for. And all of them, without fail, usually respond with those one word, same way, right? Integrity, integrity. We know that that integrity is so desired by all organizations. But what I've been always fascinated by is that, you know, from the way I see it, we have companies in which we espouse these values, these core values of trust, honesty, passion, you know, these adjectives that are essentially a depiction of a character. But our character doesn't change in adulthood. After age of 3 to 7, depending on what psychologists you believe and what research you reference. So we hire based on behavioral questions that we ask, but then we try to engage and have a productivity from our team members and employees based on a character and these core values that we have that we really cannot change, that are immutable. I think that was a big disconnect with that lack of strategic clarity that I think continues to exist, where too many organizations, I think, still use words like culture fit. And to me, cultural fit is one word, for example, I've never used in my corporate career. Well, because it's a static depiction of culture rather than a dynamic one, which has to evolve over time. You can be the most honest person in the world, but if you don't trust your executives, your management, you may not express that part of your character, which is a spectrum altogether. And you may behave in a way that may conceal the truth. And that's what you touch on in this great research that really inspired me. How many of us haven't seen leaders, executives, for example, who give the best speeches about company culture even? I've been there, I've seen it myself. You know, they've spoken about belonging, that, you know, diversity, inclusion, you know, but then you have a small intimate follow-up Q&A, a group that forms, and you have people who I witnessed myself, and they wanna, they tell this leader that, look, they want to develop as a person, they want to develop their career, they want to become, let's say, an influencer or, you know, grow in their career, and they offer them a business card. And then that same leader says, look, I don't need that business card. Look, thanks, I'm not going to take that business card because I'm not going to need it. So that makes that person not feel as important. That I've seen a few happen, is, I think, one of the problems that you have uncovered, is one of the reasons why lying becomes the norm, as you say. Now, I want to just focus a little bit on the hiring, since I gave you that example. How can we take our hiring to the next level and be a more progressive company by taking the research from your book? Do we hire for behavior? Do we maybe ask different questions, you think, in that limited time where we test for stamina and we try to really get to know the answers rather than the people themselves, and how we filter the good candidates, the strong candidates, from the poor ones, for example?
Well, I think our selection processes are super antiquated, right? We are still relying on what we scientifically know are the two least reliable devices for making positive selection decisions: the resume and the interview. Uh-huh. And yet, those are the most overused mechanisms we employ to make critical selection decisions, which is why we found out, you know, in our last book, in Rising to Power, why 50% of executives fail in the first 18 months upon being promoted to a big job, right? So we have got to get far more creative. And I think some companies are definitely doing this. Yes, our interviews have evolved to behavioral event interviewing and much more predictive kinds of, you know, behavioral stories that do, I think, in fact, yield some great insights about a person's ability to perform. But I think we've got to do more testing of people, put them in situ, put them in role plays, put them in, make them give presentations, put them in team environments in your organization and see how they do. We've got to see them in action. You know, I mean, it's almost like the you know, when you buy a house, if you rent to own kind of thing, you know, if you could rent somebody for 6 months before hiring them. But the reality is we have to broaden our ability. I agree with you that the we are so lazy in writing off they just weren't a culture fit as a reason why somebody doesn't work out. It's just, it's baloney, right? It's was a bad hire and probably your fault that you was a bad hire, but we all want to blame the candidate.
Right.
But a lot of times, one of the most interesting things we found in our tenure study was what we call the myth of the mandate, right? We set people up to fail in the hiring process. We say to them in the interview things like, wow, look at this supply chain you turned around your last company. That's what we need. Or, oh my gosh, you've done such a great job building these kinds of apps. That's what we're looking for. Or, wow, you build great brands here. We need great brands here. And when we say things like that, because we're using the resume as the device to guide our screen, we're telling them, you have a formula and we want you to apply that formula here.
Right.
So we're giving them permission to sidestep context, to sidestep their own need to adapt and learn and hit the ground running instead of hit the ground learning. So what happens? They think they have some mandate. They get hired. They show up and start doing what they believe you asked them to do. And every opening sentence that they say for the first month is, well, my last company, what we did was, or when I was at such a company, what I did was, and they annoy everybody, right? Mm-hmm. So they start slapping on their solutions that they believe you hire them to employ. And the more your organization resists them, the harder they slap. And then eventually people just start to back away. Yeah. And then what's the statement? They're obviously not a good fit.
Right.
But nobody ever does the postmortem reverse engineering to say, did we help them become not a good fit? Why were they such a great candidate when we hired them and suddenly they're a disaster in 2 months? That makes no sense. But nobody ever goes back and looks at the flaws in their assumptions or the flaws in the way they onboarded somebody or the flaws in the way they actually, sometimes the recruitment process is fine and they're a great candidate. You just did a terrible job onboarding them.
Mm-hmm. Onboarding, right, is another key issue. Do you think that part of the problem from your experience may be that the questions that are asked or the applications are focused on past experiences rather than the potential of someone? And are employers not trained enough to recognize that future potential of what somebody could bring with their diverse skills?
Tim, I think behavioral event interviews that give you a past sense of what somebody did, I mean, presuming that they're not lying, I think those can be very fine predictors of what somebody might do in the future. I also think that giving people scenarios to say, here's a situation, what would you do? Mm-hmm. Or here's a problem this role might encounter, how might you solve it? I think asking both retrospective and predictive questions are probably your best blend in terms of an interview process. But again, I think the interview itself, regardless of what you're asking, or how many people are in the room asking it, is only one device. And I think it's over relied on. I think we need many other selection tools to get a good look at somebody and their ability to contribute and participate more than just what they tell us.
Yeah. I like what you said about hit the ground learning rather than hit the ground running, because hit the ground running is another term I don't like to use, because sometimes you need direction. You need a direction that's clear, right? And that's part of that business jargon. In fact, I did a video on a company business jargon that I don't use. And that's one of the phrases there. So I'm glad you used it. Product launches. My next question is, on your experiences, from your experiences, Ron, have you seen companies become more dishonest when they either fail or when they succeed, when they kind of diverge? Have you noticed that relationship at all?
I don't know that I would compare success and failure. I would say they can, either of those experiences can lead to different types of dishonesty, right? So failure, if failure is fatal and failure is not truly a device to learn from for failure should be a pathway to justice, right? Should be a pathway to restoration and learning and improvement, but often it's not. So failure can lead to covering up. Failure can lead to people having to self-protect as a form of dishonesty. Success, by contrast, often leads to hubris, right? It leads to becoming overly wed to your success and then overly trying to protect that success from any change, right? And so then what happens is you ignore disconfirming data. When success starts to wane or when disruptions start to be introduced that threaten your success, you ignore it. You send that data out of the room. So I think, you know, both the conditions of success and failure can invite particular types of dishonesty that we have to be on guard for. I don't know that one is any worse than the other.
The second factor, accountability, that you also outline in your book, do you think that the companies in their feedback surveys, do you see that they really take the time to review the feedback, or are they using the kinds of metrics to study themselves, how they're doing at hiring, how they're doing at engagement, seriously enough? Do you think that they're being honest with themselves in terms of accountability?
I think there's a lot of variance. I think it depends on, I see a lot of companies, who the way they do the 360 is they just sort of pass it out of a door. They do the report and give it to the leader. There's no coaching, there's no follow-up, but just to get a report.
Yep.
That's, of course, that's just foolish, right? You wasted your money. I think great multi-rater feedback should be a combination of qualitative and quantitative data. When we do our assessments, our feedback process is forensic. I mean, it is incredibly comprehensive. We do really in-depth interviews, and our clients see everything we hear. So they get 20, 30, and 40 pages of data, of information, of everything, you know, so that they, and then, you know, we require a minimum of 5 months' time with our clients so that we can process the data, put together action plans, figure out what strengths we're going to better leverage in your work, what the context is requiring of you competitively, strategically, culturally, and whether or not that's, you have natural inclinations that contradict those requirements or support them. And if there are, you know, major glaring shortfalls, how are we going to cover those up? How we're going to anchor that success with a boss, a sponsor, with a team of people you lead, and with a set of peers whose success you rely on, or who rely on you for success. We make sure that data is anchored in work that is directly related to what your remit to the organization is. A lot of coaching doesn't do that. A lot of coaching just sort of comes in and isolates your behavior, gives you an instrumentation of data, sort of prioritizes scores, and puts together an action plan and calls it good, if they even do that at all. And so I think leaders don't, you know, no, I don't think there are very many leaders who get that kind of data and think, I don't care about this. I think they want to care. I think they need help. And so I think we have a long way to go before we're doing what it takes to actually help leaders metabolize feedback they get and turn it into solid action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've interviewed Steve Hertz in talent management about an interesting book called Don't Take Yes for an Answer, in which he argues that in the society that we have in the United States, which is quite litigious, many people that maybe disadvantaged because they're not getting the honest feedback on their performance because of fear of retribution or other kinds of factors. So they may hear yes, but they may not get the right, you know, kind of bonuses, or they may not get the right opportunities, yet they continue to hear yes on their performance evaluations, right? So there are many different factors, I think, in the metrics that are used.
I think that's why often you start these processes with some degree of anonymity, so there's safety mm-hmm. in that data. We have some pretty rigorous instructions we give our clients on trying to figure out who said what or what they is foolish, right? And almost always they're wrong. It doesn't matter what was said; it matters that it was said. I think what most of the psychometric research would say is that it's not that people are being too harsh in their feedback. It's that people are being too lenient because not because they're afraid of retribution, but because they're afraid of hurting somebody's career, right? Suddenly, the things that most annoy you about somebody,
right?
You start telling yourself, well, it's not so bad, or you know, they don't mean it, and you to withhold that feedback is actually cruel, because if someone's not getting honest data, they can't really change.
Business meetings. Some of the most memorable business meetings that I've been a part of were ones in which there was a free flow of information, right? Where you had brainstorming even when meetings ran over, right? And there are far and few in between these days, given the virtual world in which we live. So what role does business meeting etiquette or facilitation play on in that dishonesty?
First of all, it has to be a real meeting, right? So I mean, most of us would say that most of the time we spend in meetings is a waste of time, that it's meetings are just a chance to catch up on your email. So there has to be a real reason that people around that table are meeting. There has to be a real charter for that group to come together. They have to be clear on what decisions they get to make, what resources they get to allocate. And then there has to be dynamics where people are being honest, where people bring the truth, where if there are dueling fact bases or dueling interpretations of analyses or data, that's on the table and people can sort of, spiritedly debate that out. And there has to be real clear alignment about what decisions do get made and what's going to happen afterwards. That's not the description most people would give of their meetings. And so the cost of bringing together 9 or 10 people, right? I mean, you're talking about a run rate of thousands of dollars an hour just to put them in a room. Forget about the lost productivity or missed opportunities, or people walking out more cynical, people walking out and then having to have the real conversation in the hallway because it wasn't had in the room. The damage you do to the fabric of your organization, the damage you do to credibility and decision-making, the damage you do to execution of a strategy is untold. And so you would be better not having meetings at all than to have bad ones.
Yeah, there's some companies who have no meetings weeks. I believe Google has instituted that just recently. Other companies that are that have unlimited PTO, paid time off or vacation time, where they're finding that their employees are actually end up taking less vacation and being more productive as a result of that new policy. The fourth point is one in which you actually describe a particular case that was quite vivid in terms of the lack of cross-functional collaboration, where I think you talk about a company that had a $19.5 million investment in their product supply chain at the same time that the marketing and the sales budgets were cut, as a result of which that supply was ramped up, but that led to them being sued, the company being sued, right, for channel stuffing. Can you describe this scenario or some other ones that were most memorable from your research in terms of that lack of cross-functional collaboration?
I think that was a case of both a lack of collaboration and a lack of good decision-making, right? So that in one annual operating plan, you had three different investment choices made. This was a highly branded company, right? And so marketing was king. And to not invest in the brand was probably heretical, but they did pull back money from marketing to fund a long overdue upgrade of their supply chain footprint and their manufacturing footprint to be able to make more product. At the same time, sales territories were divided, right? So when you want to make salespeople more productive, you divide their territories and make them hungrier.
Yeah.
So you've now tripled capacity to go to get product and people to take it to market, and underinvested in the ability to keep it in the market. Yeah. Right. So no surprise that 3 years later, now nobody would have said, hey, in these three choices in the AOP, anybody see any problem with them? No, they seem like three very discrete choices. It wasn't until 3 years later when they were indicted for channel stuffing that people realized, I'm not even sure if they did realize the origins of that problem were years earlier. Mm-hmm. I think one of the great cases from, to be honest, was the comparison of two companies that in the 80s found out that their products were poisoning people, Patagonia and DuPont. Mm-hmm. Both learned their products were poisoning people and in some cases even killing them, in DuPont's case. Both did radically different things. Mm-hmm. Patagonia made the very hard choice to completely overhaul their entire supply chain and manufacturing process of other cotton products and move to an all organic cotton product line, even though they knew there wasn't enough organic cotton in the world to supply. They had to go ramp up those farmers. DuPont knew early on in the 50s that the Teflon product contained C8 or PFOA as a chemical that poisoned people. They knew in the 60s that it caused cancer in lab rats, and they knew for sure in the 80s it caused cancer in humans, several different types of cancer. But they covered it up, they denied the data, until, thank goodness for Rob Bellott, the attorney, who, because of some farmers in West Virginia whose animals were dying, whose children's teeth were falling out of their mouth, the town was experiencing incidences of cancer at a much higher rate than normal, took on the case and fought for 20 years and won almost $700 million for thousands of people, and recently just won a $4 billion settlement for forever chemicals, right? So these are now, the entire world has been poisoned. We all have C8 in our blood now because our parents all cook with Teflon. Our parents all sat Scotch guard on our couches. And so the whole world has it in their systems now to some degree. And so, you know, Rob Bellott's incredible championing of justice for those people has led to, now, money is not going to bring back, you know, lost loved ones or restore the suffering. But, you know, what the company DuPont barely exists today, right? It was broken up, it was sold off, it was merged with Dow Chemicals, and the pieces are gone. There's one little tiny element that still has the name DuPont on it, one little division, but for the most part, a once hallowed empire of respected scientists is gone.
Yeah, your examples there made me think of why I joined the pharmaceutical industry. I'm a doctor of pharmacy with a postdoctoral in medical education and publications, and when I was graduating from pharmacy school, that was the time when there were a lot of teenagers who were dying from suicide ideation and from suicides due to antidepressants. And I was always actually attracted to trying to help bring safer products with more evidence to the market, to patients. Because I've seen a 60 Minutes video to this day that's still vivid in mind, where a young group of entrepreneurs to see the conditions in which they were manufacturing these medications really clearly was short-sighted, to say the least, from their standpoint, because, you know, one day their own mother or grandmother may have to use that same medication, but they didn't have that kind of mentality. It was a kind of very episodic mentality. And unfortunately, being dishonest in corporations has grave consequences. And that's why I think your book is so important, and it's refreshing and reawakening. In terms of the solution for the future, do you think that Agile and Scrum, these companies that are instituting more agile development into their workflows or into their even designs, how their corporations are designed, do you think that may be an answer to increase that cross-functional collaboration and maybe stimulate more people to be honest?
You know, I think Agile and Scrum and Lean and, you know, they're tools. They're good tools. You know, EOS is a tool. Predictive Index is a new, you know, there's all kinds of tools. Uh-huh. I think the problem is when we try and make those tools silver bullets, when we try and turn them into something they were never meant to be, and solve more problems they can solve. You know, Agile applied right in the right settings can be great. You know, but I've seen people like in legal departments or HR departments trying to and apply Agile. That's not what it was meant for, right? It's a process tool. It's a manufacturing cost savings flexible process tool. It's a tool that's meant to sort of unite data with decision making. And so trying to blanket apply it across the enterprise and then force fit it where it doesn't belong, or it's a tool, you know, the classic analysis, right? If you give me a hammer, everything I see is a nail. Well, if you train my entire company in Agile, everything I see is a process data problem, right?
Yeah.
So I think where there are the right problems for those tools to solve, they're great tools.
Are you hopeful for what the next generation of leaders and executives can offer to a corporate design, to organizational transformation? What is the trend in general that you're noticing among these corporations?
You know, I think companies want to be better.
Social justice, right? And social
I think social justice, I think racial equity, I think environmental stewardship, I think generations of talent that want more purpose-driven environments. Mm-hmm. And I think that, so I think companies want to do better. I think they often don't know how, but I think they want to be better. And I think they're trying. And so I am hopeful that we can do better.
In general, I try to provide a global perspective, given my background here with All Out Coach, with the show and the management consulting company that I have. That's why I want to share with you just the comments that may be somewhat controversial, but that were memorable for me. With I had attended a Lincoln Film Festival here in New York, where I had been able to meet Claude Lelouch in person. As you know, he had shot the Oscar-winning picture Man and a Woman in 14 days. And he was here to promote a documentary. It was the early 2000s. And in the Q&A, he was asked the question to compare the freedom, the sense of freedom, the general sense of freedom in the United States versus other countries, right? And it was, and he mentioned, he remarked that he had been to Moscow and Russia in 1980s during the Cold War, like 1983. And then he had gone to New York in that same time, and he had seen a stark difference,
a much lower sense of freedom,
freedom of expression, freedom of communication,
a lower sense of
community in the United States versus in Russia, even a supposedly very communist country at the time. So is there any geographic difference or to company culture, organizational culture? You worked with so many global organizations, voicing opinions, holding meetings, and being able to safely share ideas.
You know, I mean, I'm not qualified to make those kinds of hard and fast conclusions, Tim. Mm-hmm. I think we know that there are certain cultures in the world where it's where your opinion is not valued, where there's extreme deference in hierarchy, mm-hmm. where, there's more proclivity toward corruption, right? So, I think we know that to be true. My research has not touched upon drawing those kinds of conclusions across certain kinds of social cultures or company cultures. So, but I think at face value, we know them to be true.
Okay, great. Well, Ron, I want to just ask you, what is one message that you would want to get across, or one tip, or something that you learned that was striking from this book that you hope the listeners of our conversation will take to heart and to their organizations as well?
We can do better. That we're in order, that when it comes to raising the bar on how we show up in the world to be the best versions of ourselves, we can do better, and we should.
What is some future areas of research that you're interested in? I know you've written many books, I believe 8. This is number 9, right?
Yeah, number 9.
Number 9. So what is number 10 going to focus on?
Oh my gosh.
What are you interested in now? Have you
thought about that? No. I don't know if there'll be a number 10, Tim. I don't know if there'll be a number 10.
Well, I'll try to inspire you to do a number 10, or maybe even team up with you on number 10. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for your time, Ron. I think this is a great topic. It's a serious one. It's one that we can all relate to, regardless of what industry we work in. It's called To Be Honest, and it's going to be released in May, correct?
That's right.
Can it be pre-ordered now, Ron?
It can be. Please go on to Amazon. If you want to learn more about the book and see more videos, there's a website, tobehonest.net. You can find the pre-order links there. But yes, pre-orders do help. So please support the cause. Amazon takes very kindly to helping books do well when they've been pre-ordered.
Yeah, so we can pre-order them now. Great. And where can they contact you? How would you like people to contact you if they want
our website? Our website is Navalent, NAVALENT.com. Come visit us there. We've got some great videos and white papers and free ebooks and all kinds of blogs and tools. So come hang out there. You can follow me on LinkedIn and follow me on Twitter.
I look forward to continuing the dialogue. Thank you. Have a great day, Ron.
Tim, thanks for having me.
Thank you.